When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm really quite pleased today because we get to talk about a book that combines maybe my two most favorite things, or at least two of like my top three favorite things in the world, history and food. The book we're talking about is titled A History of the World in 10 Dinners, 2000 Years, 100 Recipes, and it came out last year in 2023 and is fabulous. It is actually a cookbook. You could genuinely cook these things, and it's an epic excavation of history, of where these dishes came from, why they were popular, how were they developed, and really so much more. So the book is written by a wonderful team, Victoria Flexner and Jay Rifle, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Victoria to tell us about this book. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are very glad to have you, and I wonder if you could start off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit, perhaps your co-author Jay as well, and explain why you two decided to write this book.
Absolutely. So my name is Victoria Flexner. I am a food historian. And for many years, I ran a supper club in New York City called Edible History, where we recreated meals from the past in different pop-up locations around the city. Jay is the executive chef of Edible History. And when the pandemic began in 2020, you can imagine that that brought brought supper clubs to a bit of a halt. And so this book was really kind of the pandemic pivot, if you will. I essentially took, you know, a number of the dinners that we had done over the years, and I started to kind of mull over how I could find a way to still talk to people about food history, but in a different medium, because we had been doing it in person and kind of a more like restaurant style setting before. And the result of that was this book, or a proposal that I suppose became this book.
Very intriguing. And you mentioned the proposal. That is, in fact, the next thing I want to ask you about, because the subtitle of the book is 10 Dinners, or I guess the title and then continuing there. So 10 Dinners. Why 10? Which 10? How did you choose which 10?
Well, 10 felt like just a nice round number, to be completely honest. You know, 5 would have been too few, more than 10, perhaps a little bit unwieldy. But the idea, I mean, initially with the supper club, and this sort of translated over into the book as well, is that I wanted to cover time periods that we have existing recipe sources from. So even though there are, you know, like kind of bread and beer recipes from ancient Sumeria, they're not enough kind of existing recipes from societies pre-ancient Rome that we know of. So we couldn't really create like a whole picture of that kind of time and place and the culinary identity of that time and place. So ancient Rome became the starting point because the earliest known cookbook is Apicius from the 1st century. And then I really wanted to kind of do a nice sort of swath of global history. I wanted to touch on as many continents and different cultures as possible. I would have loved to do more on certain places, but either, we don't have any records from those societies, either because written records weren't kept, or perhaps they've been destroyed, or we just don't know where they are. And then it felt appropriate to end in New York City, because I never really want to talk about a sort of food history from which a person is still alive, because then you're kind of competing with nostalgia. And so ending in 19th century New York with the birth of the restaurant just felt like a nice kind of tidy place to sort of wrap up this huge global food history that goes, to Baghdad and through Asia and throughout Europe, into the Americas, into Africa. And then in New York City with the restaurant, we see all of these different cultures kind of coming together and finding, a new life in this new kind of cultural institution.
All right, so that makes sense then as very clear starting and ending points. And you mentioned kind of the travels in the middle. Ancient Rome is the first, and New York restaurants are the last. There's eight in between. What are the
Yes.
eight?
So we have Baghdad is chapter two, follows Rome. So we sort of see the collapse of the Roman Empire. Sort of, I guess I should say, there are threads that kind of tie all of these chapters together. So when I was writing the historical narrative for each chapter, I made sure that there were kind of bigger themes from the previous chapters, and themes that would kind of evolve into the next chapters, so that it felt like a cohesive narrative and not just sort of like 10 randomly selected places, just to sort of like check some diversity boxes. So with the collapse of ancient Rome, we see sort of that civilization move towards the east as the Islamic Empire emerges in the 8th century to become, one of the largest land empires in history. And Baghdad in the 10th century becomes this incredible center of really the medieval world. It was a huge kind of trading point on the Silk Road. This was the golden age of Baghdad, when art and poetry and music flourished, and of course a really incredible culinary culture emerged with this as well. And then from Baghdad, we kind of zoom out a bit more and look at the Silk Road, contextualizing Baghdad a bit, but also what was happening throughout the Asian continent in the 13th to kind of 16th centuries, but also focusing a bit, of course, on the Mongols and how much they completely transformed the political landscape of Asia, which was also then kind of, the fall of Baghdad. And so that sort of ties into the Silk Road chapter. And then in the Silk Road chapter, we focus a lot on the kind of trade of the medieval world. We don't necessarily think of Europe and Asia as being connected via trade in the Middle Ages, but they were, which is amazing and fascinating. And I think really demonstrates the ways in which our world has been globalized for a lot longer than we think it has. So throughout that chapter, we kind of stop in different places along the Silk Road, from China through India, kind of back through Baghdad, and then finally ending in what will be the next chapter, Renaissance Italy, finally ending in Italy, sort of also showing the movement of goods, particularly spices, that occurred in the medieval world. And So then the next chapter is Renaissance Italy, and we see all these spices from a far away as Indonesia and, China and India arriving in Europe and becoming this kind of luxury commodity that was incredibly expensive in medieval Europe. Europeans, elite Europeans, were obsessed with spices from the East. I think part of that is because people didn't really completely understand where they actually came from. They knew they came from very far away, but they didn't have exact maps of the world. So they came from this kind of otherworldly place somewhere to the east. And spices were utilized by the ultra wealthy kind of in the same way, to demonstrate wealth in the same way, like a sports car or luxury designer handbag might be today. And Europeans are just hooked on medieval spices. And then from Renaissance Italy, we kind of move north, still staying within Europe. We move to Tudor England, arguably sort of tracing a bit of the kind of Northern European Renaissance, obviously the reign of Henry VIII and then his daughter Elizabeth. And the food of Tudor England is just like peak kind of medieval European cuisine on steroids, especially when it comes to the use of spices. It's just fantastic. It's showmanship, it's bravado. There's the cock and thrice, sewing different animals together to create new mythical beasts. It's just completely over the top and insane, as often sort of the history of that time period as reflected in pop culture is. So that just sort of had to that had to be in there. And then from England we move south down to Spain, to a land called Al-Andalus, which is essentially what the Iberian Peninsula was called when it was under Muslim rule. And I have sort of a special personal love for this sort of historical period. I've always loved Islamic history and found it incredibly fascinating. And I remember when I was studying Islamic history at Edinburgh, when I was at university, learning that there had been a caliphate in mainland Europe was completely mind-blowing to me. This was not something I had been taught in my American education. And so I've been quite sort of fixated on this notion of how we are often presented history in one way today, and it perhaps is only presented to us that way because of the current society that we live in or the culture that we live in. And it maybe hasn't always been that way. Maybe people actually used to see things like borders and boundaries differently. And so Al-Andalus was the first caliphate in mainland Europe, was started by Abd al-Rahman II, who was a prince from the Umayyad Caliphate that had ruled from Damascus in Syria. And his family was overthrown during the Abbasid Revolution. It was this incredibly bloody revolution in which the Abbasid family overthrew the Umayyads. Most of his family was killed either in the revolution itself or at this like really kind of dark conciliatory dinner that feels like it has a lot of the hallmarks of kind of George R. R. Martin, Game of Thrones, red wedding dinner. Basically, everyone was invited over and they were all killed at the end of the meal. Somehow, at the end of the meal, Al-Rahman escapes. He disappears for 7 years. He pops up in North Africa, his mother's lands. And he was this incredible figure because instead of, just sort of living out the rest of his life in exile, far away from the new power center of, his enemies who had slaughtered his entire family, he went on to kind of amass an army of Berber tribesmen and go forth and to conquer Spain and parts of Portugal. and established a caliphate that would rule in one form or another from the kind of 8th century all the way up until 1492, when the last Muslim stronghold in Spain, Granada, was captured by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, that pivotal year, 1492, which was, of course, the year that Christopher Columbus set sail to try and find a route to India, because Europeans were still obsessed with black pepper. They wanted to find a kind of direct access point to this place called India, because they knew that black pepper came from India and other spices came from near there, but they didn't quite understand how to get there. So we see the beginning of the age of exploration at the end of the Al-Andalus chapter, which leads into the next chapter, chapter 7, which is the Great Circulation. And I suppose this chapter could have been called the Age of Exploration, but I find that to be a rather problematic term in this day and age. So kind of going off of the work that that Alfred Crosby did in the 1970s, coining this movement of animals and plants and things as a consequence of colonial contact around the world, starting in 1492, he coined that kind of entire process, the Columbian Exchange. But again, perhaps we don't want to put a sort of genocidal monster on a pedestal. So the Great Circulation was the term that Jay and I felt would be much more appropriate for a cookbook about world history, in this day and age. So in the Great Circulation chapter, we follow a number of different kind of European explorers. I'm doing air quotes around that as they, conquer ruthlessly and very bloodily different places in the Americas, the Inca Empire, the Aztec Empire. We see recipes from these places just before European contact, and then a little bit how they changed after European contact. I think this chapter is absolutely fascinating, with the kind of Incan indigenous ceviche. There were no lemons or limes in the Americas until they were brought over by the Europeans. So fermented, passion fruit was used to kind of cook the fish. That was the acidity that was used to cook the fish. Or in mole, we see, traces of kind of Aztec cooking with the tomatoes. Tomatoes are indigenous to Mexico and were domesticated by the Aztecs. And we see chocolate, but we also see all of these spices and sort of this stew preparation that's very reminiscent of Middle Eastern cooking, which was obviously an influence that moved to Spain under Muslim rule, and then from Spain to Mexico. So it's kind of this turning point, as far as I'm concerned, in the broad narrative of global food history. Every single cuisine across the world is fundamentally changed by European contact and by the Great Circulation, and ingredients that didn't exist in certain places are introduced to new continents. The chili pepper is introduced from the Americas to Asia. Potatoes from Peru are introduced to Europe, etc. And after that point, you could say that kind of every culinary identity that exists today is really a result of this time period. And then we move from the Great Circulation into the Ethiopian Empire, which ruled for an incredibly long time, from the 13th to the 19th centuries, and was actually one of the earliest Christian empires. I believe Armenia was the first country in the world to become officially Christian, and Ethiopia was the second. And so there's this really interesting culture here on the Swahili coast, on the east coast of Africa, right across from Arabia, surrounded by predominantly Muslim countries. Ethiopia remained this sort of Christian enclave, and as a result, a really unique kind of African culture emerged in this setting. I talk quite a lot about the churches of Ethiopia, which are unlike anything else in the world. And the art and the architecture is just so unique and so very different to anything you would see in the equivalent kind of Christian medieval European time period, as is the food. It's a very meat-forward sort of diet, one could say. As well as a lot of honey, but there's some really fantastic recipes in that chapter that we were so pleased to find from a 19th century feast that had been hosted by Empress Tetu of Ethiopia, and she basically incorporated traditional dishes from across the Ethiopian Empire. At this huge feast in the early 19th century. So sort of working backwards from there, we were able to figure out a number of really wonderful traditional dishes. And something I found quite striking when I was studying the kings and the queens of the Ethiopian Empire was how isolated they became towards the end of their rule, which I suppose is something that you could kind of pinpoint in towards the downfall of a lot of monarchies. The king or the queen becomes very isolated from the people. And so from there, a parallel could be drawn to the final days of the French monarchy. And so in chapter 9, we move to Versailles. The chapter mainly focuses on the food of Louis XIV's reign. So it's pre-French Revolution. But it kind of leads up to it as the food gets, more and more kind of elaborate and ridiculous. One could sort of see how the monarchy was becoming increasingly separated and unaware of the situation of the people over whom they were ruling. But it was also a really important moment in the development of kind of modern Western cooking. There was a big move away from medieval European spice-laden dishes, more of an emphasis on the flavor of the ingredients themselves, which I suppose kind of continues to this day in some sense. We like to go to the farmer's market and get vegetables that really taste like what they're supposed to taste like, or, eat a free-range organic, chicken that really tastes like chicken. And a lot of this sort of, I guess, style of cooking really emerged in this period of sort of 17th and 18th century France. A lot of haute French cuisine was really codified in this period. And as we all know, for whatever reason, French food to this day remains sort of on a pedestal globally as sort of, this thing to kind of work towards. And I say that with no shade towards French food. I actually am half French, but it is interesting that French food remains that to this day, whereas other cuisines, aren't sort of admired as much necessarily. And then from after the French Revolution, a number of chefs who had been working for royals or for the nobility or just for incredibly wealthy people in Paris found themselves suddenly out of employment. And a lot of them followed the waves of immigration to the United States. And it was from some of these French chefs who immigrated to New York in the 19th century that we find the very first restaurants opening up in New York City. And I say that not that restaurants didn't exist prior to the 19th century or that New York invented the restaurant, just the concept of eating out existed in very different forms throughout most of human history. But the restaurant as we know it today, where it's a space that you walk into, there is a menu, there is a style, there's a philosophy behind the menu. You can order what you want from that menu in sort of a broad range of hours, is actually quite a modern invention. And we really see the emergence of that modern institution in New York City in the 19th century. And then, as I said before, kind of all of these different cuisines from all over the world find new life in the restaurants of New York City.
Well, I mean, I think that answer does exactly what you said at the beginning, right? It creates a narrative out of this so that it's not 10 separate instances. And especially with the way you've described that just now, I mean, it comes together as an incredibly coherent story of history. But obviously, at some point, you had to like make these decisions, right? About how do we tell this part of the story? How do we do that? So if we sort of step back from like the polished final product, when you go back to thinking about how you put this together, were there dinners or times or places that almost made this cut of the final 10?
That's such a good question. I was quite intrigued to do something about the Ottoman Empire, but I felt ultimately like there was a good amount of representation of the Islamic world between Baghdad and Al-Andalus, and also with the Silk Road chapter. Excuse me. So it was tricky, kind of trying to really strike that balance, and then we didn't want to do too much within Europe, but also really wanted to hit these points. I would have loved to do more. More in Africa. I was really hoping that I was going to be able to find some old culinary manuscripts from Timbuktu because there were such incredible libraries there. Hoping that perhaps, unfortunately, a lot of the libraries in Timbuktu that had been built during the kind of height of the Mali Empire were destroyed by ISIS in the last couple, I guess, decade or so, which is really just such a tragedy for humanity. But also, made that search very difficult. And perhaps there are documents that made their way out of Timbuktu before that happened, or at any other point, in the last few centuries, and maybe they're sitting somewhere waiting to be discovered by someone. But I wasn't able to find anything. And we also did debate potentially doing a menu that was just set in Han China, but then also ultimately decided that we hit upon China a good amount in the Silk Road chapter. And so yeah, it was a really delicate kind of dance. And then also to some degree, what are the recipes from these time periods, and are recipes from certain places, perhaps more unique to that place. It was complicated. There were a lot of factors to consider for sure. And in an alternate reality, there could be a History of the World and 10 Dinners part two with 10 totally different places telling another history of the world.
No, but it's fascinating to think, to hear about kind of the factors you were considering and how you went through that process. All right, so we know which 10 are in, we know which 10 or some that did not quite make it. I want to talk more about like what actually is here. You've given us the grand historical narrative, but this is also literally a cookbook, right? You could actually cook these things. So can you take us through that process? So you find some document that's a good few hundred years old that describes a recipe. Obviously, that's a very different kitchen. That's a very different sort of grocery shopping experience. That's a very different like manuscript culture or writing culture. How did you get from that to the recipe that's actually in the book?
Well, a lot of trial and error. But it also depends on the recipe source. So, like with ancient Rome, Apicius's recipes are pretty vague, I suppose you could say, in comparison to a modern cookbook, which does everything, like tells you to take the thing out of the oven when it's done, like as if you wouldn't know to do that, which I always find so silly. And certainly a lot of the medieval European culinary manuscripts are incredibly vague, take the meat, add these spices to it, and cook it until it's done. Or, in the time it takes a man to walk around a field, okay, well, what field? Or in the time it takes to say, 10 Hail Marys, it's like, okay, well, what kind of Hail Mary are you saying? So there's units of time measurement that are completely different to our own, which, you kind of have to take from the description of the dish what you think the end result is supposed to be. Also, often the sections of those kind of medieval European manuscripts would say things like roast meat. So it's like, okay, well, we know what a roast meat is. So that kind of gives you some indication to like what the consistency of the dish is supposed to be. But in terms of measurements, that's really tricky, and brings up a whole host of questions about the ways in which our tastes have changed, not our taste buds, because evolutionarily our taste buds have not changed over the last few thousand years. But what we think tastes good today is not necessarily what someone else thought tasted good a long time ago. I remember years ago at an edible history supper club, I was testing out this recipe. It was a Renaissance Italian recipe for mushrooms, and it called for like nutmeg and ginger and cinnamon and cloves and just so many spices. Okay, well, this is going to be quite interesting. And it tasted as old as I imagine that manuscript would smell today, as like a really old piece of paper. It just tasted like musky, and it was just bad. And I wasn't, liberally dousing it. I was trying to use kind of small quantities, so I could adjust accordingly. And I suppose in Renaissance Italy, maybe someone thought that tasted really good because also those spices would have been so expensive and such a luxury item that, there's kind of a different, you're just thinking about that taste differently. I always like to use the comparison that if I took like a really cheap piece of fish, like a tilapia, and, cooked it for people, but I took it from, a pink styrofoam kind of plastic container from the supermarket shelf, cooked it in front of them just in like some oil and put it on a paper plate and was like, here, people wouldn't be incredibly impressed. But if I hid the packaging, took the tilapia, put it on a beautiful wooden cutting board and got a Japanese knife out and sliced it very finely and maybe served it with like some really nice soy sauce and said that it was this, rare, special fish, people would be like, oh my gosh, so good, it tastes so wonderful. So, presentation, how we think of where it comes from also completely defines and informs the way we experience taste. But in terms of the recipes, again, so medieval Europe is quite vague. But that 10th century Baghdad, I mean, that we used this cookbook called The Annals of the Caliph's Kitchen, which was compiled in the 10th century from the Caliph recipe collections of the 8th and 9th century. And it's an incredible, incredible book. It is organized in a way that a modern cookbook would be, but it also has actual measurements of time and units of measurement, how much to use of each thing, how to prepare, clean the pot that you're going to cook the stew in. And really, we don't see anything this detailed cookbook-wise until probably until kind of 18th or 19th century France. So, also depends on the culture, and how they presented information, which is interesting.
So, was it those ones that say things like walk around the field and then it's done? Were those ones the ones that were the most challenging to research or write?
I think so. Yeah, I think for Jay, definitely those ones proved to need a little more kind of trial and error. So tricky, but also not impossible. And often when you're recreating these recipes, I mean, part of the pleasure of recreating these recipes is to be, a detective and to try out a number of different kind of methods and to see what works and to sort of debate, well, should I use my food processor? Should I use the mortar and pestle as they would have back then? And just to kind of to be with the ingredients themselves and to think about the different ways in which they would have been handled, and again, kind of going back to how the taste of them would have been experienced for someone back then. I always like to say that, Edible History, the supper club was really trying to kind of invite guests on a journey of sensorial history. You can read an old book, you can look at a painting, you can go to a historic home, castle, religious site, and you can be in that place, that historical place with other senses, but to smell and taste what someone else smelled and tasted 1,000 years ago is, I think, allows us to kind of open up the ways in which we think about the past, and it allows you to inhabit for a moment, kind of like a shared metaphysical space with someone else. Not to get too woo-woo, but truly, to me, sometimes I feel like it's the closest we can come to time traveling, and to being with the experiences of those who came before us.
I mean, that perspective really gives the sense that this research process, this writing process, the testing process, the eating it is quite fun, involves a lot of surprises, kind of has a lot of curiosity built into it. If that's kind of the context for all of it, was there a particular recipe or even sort of a dinner within the book that you found the most surprising or unexpected or fun to create and write about?
It's like choosing a favorite child.
I didn't frame it that way, but yes.
I do think that the Al-Andalus chapter, even though it was a period of history that I was already familiar with, perhaps I hadn't done as much digging into the culinary history. And I was really wonderfully surprised to see how diverse the cookbooks from Al-Andalus were, even though they were almost certainly written by Muslim authors. They also included Jewish recipes for the Sabbath and recipes for Lent for Christians. And I think that was quite amazing to see that, that would have been a book that was expected to be utilized by a huge, like quite a diverse audience. I mean, a lot of cookbooks today aren't even that kind of wide-ranging in their scope. It's like 30-minute weeknight meals for vegans or summer salads or, desserts for every season of the year. What an incredible approach, and also shows that people were probably eating food from outside their religious community in Al-Andalus, which I also think is really fascinating and really wonderful. So I found that quite interesting about Al-Andalus. I think in for the Ethiopia chapter, I didn't realize how meat heavy it was going to be. I know I said that, and it's not to say that vegetables weren't consumed. Certainly a lot of lentils and sort of grains, obviously injera, they're kind of like flatbread, are a huge part of the diet. But it's a lot of meat. It's a lot of meat. And when I was reading this Portuguese traveler made his way to Ethiopia somehow in the 16th century. And I stumbled upon his diary while I was doing my research. And he, I mean, and Europeans were eating a good amount of meat as well, but he was shocked at how much meat was being consumed and how at a banquet, it would just be like 20 different dishes of meat prepared in different ways, of course. So I suppose, yeah. So it's a lot of meat, which I found just really interesting.
Thank you for sharing that. Obviously, reading it, there were a number of things I found surprising. So it's interesting to get your perspective on it, having gotten so much more into the sources. I must admit, though, that for me, not all the surprises I had reading it were necessarily good. Sometimes I read things and were like, I don't know if I would want to eat that. I definitely don't know if I want to cook that. I've got some eyebrows raised, maybe I'll come round, but first glance, not loving it. Were there any dishes that you had that reaction to?
I have to say that there aren't any dishes in this book that I wouldn't eat. But perhaps that's why these dishes made their way into the book. The eel was incredibly popular in Renaissance Italy, but I suppose throughout medieval Europe, a lot of recipes for eel pie that eel just doesn't do it for me. So you won't find any recipes for eel pie, and perhaps I have done a disservice to the history, the edible history of eel pie in medieval Europe by not including one. But I'm sure if anyone is incredibly curious, good old Google could help you find something in that regard. Also, in Renaissance Italy, something that was quite popular was dolphin, which for many reasons we were just never going to include. So there was some things that when looking at the sources, it was like, ooh, yeah, that's not really moral. We can't put that in there. Or, people just aren't really going to want to eat it. But I am very curious to know which ones had your eyebrows raised.
Maybe we'll discuss that another time.
Okay.
I do want to ask though, not give short shrift to the history side of the writing, because we've talked a lot about the writing of the recipe side of things. But of course, as your wonderful narrative towards the beginning of our interview suggests, the book has like sections that don't have cooking in them or don't have recipes on the page. They're explaining all these wonderful things about how they go together. I suppose, given that many of the listeners, myself included, have at various points written history, we know the challenge of kind of, well, what do you pick? How do you decide what to highlight? How do you decide what to leave out? And especially when you're writing, I imagine, in a cookbook rather than like, a nerdy academic monograph, you have even more intense like space constraints and audience considerations. How did you decide kind of how to tell those historical sections of the book, which aspects to highlight, what audience to aim for? How did you figure that part out?
Well, it was a process. When I started writing the book, and I have to shout out my editor, Elizabeth Smith, who really helped me find some confidence in writing history kind of the way that I wanted to. But perhaps because of my training as a historian, you couldn't write this way. But I decided that I really wanted to write the way that I spoke at a dinner. Or I suppose perhaps the way I'm speaking now, but maybe a little bit less ums and ahs. I wanted to speak and write in a way that just was accessible and easy, and I wanted it to be entertaining and lively for people who know a lot about history or any of these time periods. I wanted it to be able to be appreciated by experts, but also I wanted someone who knows absolutely nothing about, say, Versailles, to be able to pick up that chapter and feel like they've really learned something and that it hasn't been an intimidating process to learn it. I think I completely understand and value the style of certain academic historical writing. But I think that there is, you know, there's space for pop history, for history to be written in an accessible way. And having done these historical dinners for almost a decade prior to writing this book, I had a style of recounting history already. It was just in a kind of oral, ephemeral kind of medium. So translating that into the written word was like a little clunky at first, but then once I sort of got my footing, it felt so easy. And I remember as I was writing the ancient Rome chapter, because I did write all of these chapters in order, I wanted to walk the reader through a day in the life of just kind of an average person in Rome. And as I was writing those descriptions of, you know, just a worker kind of commuting to work in ancient Rome, picking up dinner on the way home for his family, it sort of clicked that the recipes are there to provide a sort of sensorial road in to experience history. And so the writing should support that and try and be in that time and place as much as possible as well to help the reader even further as, you know, maybe they cook one of these dishes, to be able to also visualize what it would have looked like, how it would have felt, what the sounds would have been, what you would have seen walking around. And so I kept that in mind and sort of in as many chapters as I could, really tried to find an individual or a person to place the narrative with. So in Renaissance Italy, that's Lucrezia Borgia. In the Great Circulation chapter, you know, we spend some time with the Incan emperor Atahualpa, and in Ethiopia with the emperors. I wanted it to feel like a really appropriate companion. And then it was tricky with space constraints. You know, there were definitely moments where I was like, oh gosh, how do I explain the entire political situation of the Silk Road, you know, for three centuries in a couple paragraphs? But also sometimes having less room to say something is almost easier. I don't know. It seemed to work once I got into the rhythm of, we're not going to be able, I kept reminding myself of the title, this is not the history of the world, it is just a history of the world. And there are many other histories that are not included in this book. So sort of taking some of that pressure off myself to know that I'm not going to be able to include everything was helpful. I, you know, there were a number of chapters where I kept having to actually just cut myself off from research because I was like, I could just continue to research this one subject for the next like 5 years. I have to start writing the chapter now because I am actually on a deadline with a publisher. So some rules in place from the, you know, the cookbook gods and powers that be, and some help from a really wonderful editor, I think helped it come together in a nice way, or at least I hope.
Hmm. No, thank you for taking us both kind of through the process of the recipe side and the history writing side, as they're both such key components to this. Keeping in mind the idea of not putting the pressure on yourself to explain every single piece, can I ask you to highlight some key things that you hope readers and eaters take away from the book?
I hope that the interconnectedness of our world is something that readers and eaters, however you choose to experience this book, take away from it, because I think one of the biggest themes is connection, whether in the ancient medieval world, that's initially through trade, and perhaps, you know, a knight in England doesn't, you know, he will never meet the person producing the black pepper that he's sprinkling on his dinner. But in later centuries, you know, some of these people will meet each other. So the interconnectedness, even before all of the continents of the world were violently sort of thrust into contact with one another. And then after 1492, I think from just a history of food perspective, it's absolutely fascinating to think about the ways in which the Great Circulation changed the way that we eat. Over the last couple of years, as I was working on this book, and since this book has come out, when I've met, readers from various places that are mentioned in these books, they're like completely flabbergasted. Like an Italian realizing that like tomatoes are not in fact from Italy was like, no, come on, like you're kidding me. This is made up. What are you talking about? Someone from China not believing me that, there were no chili peppers in Sichuanese food prior to European contact. And just the way in which it makes all of us kind of reevaluate our own identities, because our own identities are so, for most people, are quite tied up into the things that we eat, and the places that we come from, find representation in national dishes. But if you really break down like the ingredients in most national dishes of most countries across the globe, all of those ingredients come from all over the place. And I think that's just so amazing, and hopefully it can help us all just kind of, think about our identities and sort of cultural boundaries in a different way.
Lovely takeaway. Thank you. What have you learned from doing all of this?
Oh, boy. quite a lot, to be honest. I feel like I've learned quite a lot about all of these time periods, which is just wonderful and an absolute dream. The entire time I was writing this book, I just kept thinking, I can't believe I get to do this. What a joy and what a privilege to just study history and old recipes and to be able to share that with people. Gosh, there's so many things. I wouldn't really know where to begin, but maybe my biggest takeaway is actually what I just sort of said. I hope everyone else takes away from it, because perhaps I also hadn't realized how kind of interconnected it all is. I knew it was, obviously, when I kind of wrote this proposal and chose these chapters. I had these threads in mind. But perhaps I hadn't quite realized it. And I think I also learned a lot about a few distinct figures. I'm kind of obsessed with Abd al-Rahman from Al-Andalus. I don't understand how a television series has not been made about his life. I think Lucrezia Borgia is completely misunderstood, and I feel really bad for her. I think it was also really, it was fun getting to know a lot of these individuals, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that absolutely does. So thank you for sharing that. I do have one final question, if you'll allow it. The book is obviously out. People can go read it, cook from it themselves. Is there anything, therefore, that you're currently working on or looking to work on now that this is out in the world?
Yes. I have started publishing a weekly newsletter called Edible History, which you can find if you just go to the Edible History website or my website, victoriaflexner.com. It's on the Substack platform. So if you are already on Substack, you can find the Edible History newsletter there. And each week I publish kind of little musings on singular food histories told through history and story, sometimes personal story, things like the pineapple or the oyster or nutmeg. And that's been a really fun project to kind of kick off the new year with. And I'm also working on a couple other book ideas, but TBD on those exact ones. But hopefully some exciting news in the months to come.
Well, we shall wait with anticipation and, of course, have the newsletter in the meantime and have this book. Listeners can go search it out. The title is A History of the World in 10 Dinners, 2000 Years, 100 Recipes. And it's written together by Jay Rifle and our lovely guest today, Victoria Flexner. Victoria, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun. I had a wonderful time talking with you.